From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Well, we'll start out today's show with Chris Crockett, the Native Aquatics Project Leader for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. He will talk about the reintroduction of Columbia spotted frogs to the Swanner Preserve right here in Summit County. He'll talk about a new wildlife action plan that the division is working on currently, and also a new app that I'm excited about.
You always get excited about
I am. Apps. I'm excited about, you know.
This is a frog
this
app?
This is an amphibian identification field guide.
Get out of here.
Right there in your phone.
All right.
Who's not excited?
Exactly. Well, how are we going to top that? Well, in the second half of the show, the Park City Film Series is partnering with the Park City Museum to present a screening of A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet, on October 16th. The film explores the environmental movement, grassroots, and global activism spanning 50 years from conservation to climate change.
Then Katie Wang with the Park City Film Series, Sandra Morrison with the Park City Museum, and Robin Geist with the Summit Land Conservancy will all join us in the second half of the show to discuss the film and the Q&A with director Mark Kitchell via Skype following the film.
Right, all that and some news about the forum held 2 weeks ago at St. Luke's Episcopal Church regarding the proposed Uinta Express pipeline. The pipeline would remove up to 250 oil tankers from the highway each day, but is it worth it? We'll discuss.
Good question. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. And it gets started right after a few words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts, here to tell you about Park City Specialty Clinic, located inside Park City Medical Center on the second floor of the hospital. At Park City Specialty Clinic, you'll find OBGYNs and general surgeons. Whether you're trying to get pregnant, want to deliver your baby close to home, or have abdominal concerns of a different kind, the doctors at the Park City Specialty Clinic can help. Call 435-658-7400 to make your appointment. This Park City Specialty Clinic is a proud supporter of KPCW and is part of the not-for-profit Intermountain Healthcare System.
Come celebrate all things Summit County at the 5th Annual Harvest Festival, Saturday, October 4th, from noon till 5 at the High Star Ranch in Camas. Enjoy local foods, Utah craft beers, kids activities, and over 30 local vendors. Featuring live music from Shane Jackman, Small House Strings, and Shea Zero. Presented by KPCW supporters, the Uinta Headwaters RC&D Council, and Recycle Utah, your local nonprofit recycling center. More information at recycleutah.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak across the board. And on the phone with us for the first half of the show today is Chris Crockett. He's the Native Aquatics Project Leader for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources and is here to talk about a variety of things related to that. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So start by telling us what a Native Aquatics Project Leader does for the division. What does your role look like?
That's a good question. You know, most people would probably be pretty envious of my job. Fortunately, I get to spend a lot of time in the beautiful state of Utah, romping through some of the streams and swamps, etc. My more technical aspect of the job is to help monitor fish and amphibian populations throughout the state. We also spend quite a bit of time doing restoration projects on public land, as well as working with private landowners to increase the health of the wetlands and rivers throughout the state.
So one main project that you have been working on in Summit County for quite a few years now is the reintroduction of the Columbia spotted frog onto the Swanner Preserve, where, in full disclosure, I, of course, work. So talk a little bit about the history of this project.
Okay. Maybe just start out with a little bit of background about the species. So Columbia spotted frog historically were found throughout much of the state of Utah. A lot of people hear the name Columbia and kind of, you know, wrinkle their nose and wonder where it got its name from. Actually, the majority of Columbia spotted frogs are found within the Columbia River Basin. So, you know, areas in Idaho, Montana, Oregon, places like that. So that's actually where it gets its name. The frogs here in Utah are actually on the southern fringe of that range. So they're somewhat isolated, and that's led to some issues along the way. So you started out with a population that's kind of on the fringe of its range. It's a little bit isolated. You put on top of that some of the usual litany of issues that have, wildlife face these days, like loss of habitat, exotic species, things like that. And we started seeing a decline throughout the state, really, about 30 or 40 years ago. We were losing populations. We were seeing dwindling numbers. And one of those areas that started to dwindle was around Swanner Preserve. Historically, there was quite a few Columbia spotted frogs within that preserve and within some of the other areas in Park City. So fortunately, with Swanner and with Nell, we had some great partners, and there was a lot of restoration work on the wetlands themselves that Swanner Preserve and some of their partners initiated several years ago. Once we started seeing all that great habitat come back in, we were interested in seeing what we could do to help the frogs reestablish their population.
So the frogs are currently listed as like a Utah-sensitive species. What does that mean?
That's a good question. You know, different states have different terminology, essentially. But here in Utah, it's called a species of greatest conservation need. And that's a bit of a mouthful, so we just typically just call them a sensitive species. That, in essence, means it has some state protection, but it's still within state jurisdiction, so it's not an endangered species.
Okay, great. So an introduction is kind of a fun thing to watch or to be involved in. So explain a little bit about like what it involves, what it looks like out there on the ground.
Gotcha. Well, most of our efforts thus far involve what we call head starting efforts. And so head starting, in essence, is where we go to a healthy population, say along the Provo River in Heber Valley, where we've done a lot of work historically. We have thriving populations. We go into that thriving population and we essentially collect some egg masses, some eggs of those individuals, because we know we can take a few from that population. It's not going to hurt anything. We'll then take those eggs and put them in what are essentially 1 by 1 meter cages out in the preserve. And so within those cages, the eggs or the tadpoles as they hatch are now protected from predators. We can go in and kind of keep a close eye on them. We can actually supplementally feed them with spinach or brine shrimp or some of our other varieties of food that we'll give them. It gives us an opportunity to protect them, to keep an eye on them, and kind of coddle them, if you will, a little bit as they're growing and getting used to that new habitat.
Chris is raising his eyes at the diet these fish are, or these
right, spinach.
Metamorphs are receiving. Yeah, exactly. They get organic spinach.
It's, really? They get good stuff?
Only the best.
Well, and yes. I assume that this is done in the spring?
It is. So this year we collected eggs from the Heber Valley area. I believe it was early April. It all depends on the weather, as you can imagine. You know, if it's a really cold year, then things may get started a bit late. This year, the ones in the Heber Valley were about early April. We gave them a week or so, and then we went in and collected 16 egg masses. The majority of those we moved directly to the preserve within those Head Start cages. There were a few that we kept out and raised at our facilities here in Springville. And really the reason we were doing that is we were kind of hedging our bets, because if you lay those eggs out there, hopefully they're going to do great at Swanner, but as you guys know, occasionally there's a late storm that comes through. It can get really cold, and then that can reduce your survivorship, essentially, of those eggs. So we hedge our bets by having some that we put directly out there and others that we raise to tadpoles and then move the tadpoles themselves in the cage. It worked out this year that the ones that we just put directly in the preserve as eggs actually did tremendously better. So we just did our release, late August. Seems like it was just yesterday. And we released...
You sound like a proud father, Chris.
Yeah. We actually released over 200 what we call metamorph frogs. So just tiny little frogs. They're only about an inch long. They've just undergone metamorphosis. So they've just turned from, you know, your polywog, your tadpole, into what looks like a small frog. And we released over 200, and then we had another 200 tadpoles tadpoles that were a little behind schedule that we went ahead and released. So it was, this year was a success. We were aiming to release hopefully 100, and we got 200 plus.
Wow, so who wants to gobble up tadpoles and the little frogs? Who's their predators?
That's a good question. I mean, some of the wildlife that we love the most on the preserve are actually predators. Sandhill cranes, mostly, you know, avian predators on the preserve. And so you can imagine they've developed to be pretty wary around any sort of shadow that comes over them or whatnot. And that's actually one of the complications. Nell can tell you, she got a call from me, and I was worried that the frogs out there weren't doing very well, and they had pretty much gotten so smart that as soon as I approached, they just completely disappeared and buried into the bottom of the cage. So I was a little panicky until I started actually releasing them, and then, again, we found way more than we were expecting. So released them from those Head Start cages, and now they're on their own.
So how do you define success with this going forward?
You know, there's several steps along the way. I mean, obviously, we were excited that we had successful hatch, if you will, of those eggs, and, you know, they made it all the way to a juvenile frog. The real success is going to be, though, in 3, 4, 5 years when hopefully those frogs are now adults and they come back and reproduce. That's the true definition of success, is when we see those individuals that we released come back and reproduce themselves.
And so this is kind of a continuation of a previous, you know, reintroduction. It's a continuation of this effort. So in the past, we have seen some egg masses. What does that mean for the population out there?
You know, you're absolutely right. We saw some initial success in, I believe it was 2010, when we started seeing reproduction of some of those individuals released. We saw an initial flurry of success, and then since then we haven't seen very many egg masses of that initial release, not enough to support the population. That was a bit discouraging, but when we look at some of our other populations throughout the state, we saw a decline for whatever reason about the same time. You know, we had several years of drought. We had some inhospitable conditions. So we're going to give it another try. We've learned a lot through some of our work introducing fish, that we often know that, you know, you reintroduce fish, you reintroduce frogs. It doesn't always take the first time. You can imagine there's lots of variables that have to happen, that have to be right for that special mix of circumstances for those to take. And so we're going to aim to release another, hopefully 150 each year for the next 3 years. We'll sit back and wait. We'll see if those individuals reproduce, and we've got our fingers crossed that they will.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Chris Crockett. He is an aquatic biologist with the Utah Department of Wildlife Resources. We're talking about the Columbia spotted frog and its reintroduction into the Swanner Preserve, where it once had a full, probably thriving population for a number of years or decades or so, and then due to, I guess, operational conditions there and like you say, some drought conditions.
And the wetlands were drained for many years for various, you know, agricultural uses.
The frogs went away. So now they're being reintroduced. So Chris, why do we need frogs? What role do they play in the ecosystem?
You know, that's a great question. Amphibians are important for a lot of reasons. I mean, you can imagine there on the preserve that those frogs, when they were there, served a very important role in the ecosystem. I mean, again, some of our, you know, favorite wildlife on the preserve are sandhill cranes, and amphibians are a major food source for sandhills. So from the aspect of wildlife watching and you know, value, they're definitely key to the ecosystem. In some areas, tadpoles themselves are very important grazers. You know, they start out at the base of the food chain. They eat a lot of algae. As they grow and turn into small little frogs, those frogs will eat a lot of insects, some of which, you know, we consider a nuisance, like mosquitoes. You know, there's kind of a sentimental value, quite frankly, that I feel like most people have about frogs, too. If you're like me, you grew up chasing frogs, you kind of associate listening to frogs with, you know, peaceful trips out in the mountains or camping or something like that. What a lot of people really probably don't understand is that frogs are very important for human health. Most people have kind of heard about some of the unique enzymes that they find on the skin of frogs. A lot of those are being utilized to develop treatments for things such as cancer that obviously can, you know, definitely benefit us. Actually, there's a northern leopard frog, which is another frog found right around Park City area. They've recently used an enzyme from their skin to help treat brain cancer. So there's lots of connections there, both within the ecosystem and within our own health, that amphibians play an important role in.
So what kind of a sound do they make? What's their song like?
Is Columbia it just typical? That's a good question. Columbia spotted frogs, it's a fairly faint sound. I suspect if you were a female Columbia spotted frog, you've gotten pretty good at listening to it. But it actually sounds like someone tapping on a log. It's surprising because Columbia spotted frogs are one of our larger frogs here in the state, but they don't have a very loud voice compared to, say, a chorus frog that are also found in the Park City area that are tiny, like, you know, an inch to a half inch long, but have a very loud chorus.
Hmm.
So tell us what Columbia spotted frogs look like and also what chorus frogs look like, so when people see these things out and about, they can identify them.
You know, Columbia spotted frogs, they're typically, as you might imagine, spotted. They have a background of anywhere from a pretty bright, almost Kermit the Frog green, down to a very dark green. They'll have spots on their back that are just black. That helps distinguish them from the other frog I spoke of, northern leopard frogs, which will have brown spots that are kind of outlined in white or yellow. The chorus frogs that we spoke of, they're very cryptic. Again, they're only about an inch long, and they'll be anywhere from kind of a mottled brown to a mottled green, and you can typically look at their backs and see what looks like either three lines running up their backs, or sometimes those lines cross, almost forming an X. And I know most people probably didn't quite get that visualization in your head, but there's lots of good resources that we could help provide. We've actually started with some of our partners a Facebook page. It's called Utah's Frogs and Toads, and it has all kinds of good pictures. It has information about what we've done here at Swanner, including some recent video. That'd be a great resource for your listeners to look at. Also, AmphibiaWeb, if you just do a Google search for AmphibiaWeb, has some great information on amphibians.
All right, so how do these frogs survive the winter? What do? Do they want to come inside?
Occasionally, you know, in a few months, we'll soon start getting lots of calls from people with frogs in their window wells because they're a nice little warm spot.
Really?
But the rest of them will typically find a nice beaver dam or a muskrat mound or a small mammal burrow even, and try to get underground where you've got a little bit of refuge from the cold and temperatures. There will be some of them that will just swim to the bottom of a pond where you have soft sediments, and they'll bury themselves in those sediments, and that's where they'll spend the winter, completely underwater. Essentially, their metabolism shuts down. They don't need very much oxygen. The oxygen that they do need, they're just essentially getting it through their skin. They're using their skin like we use our lungs to absorb oxygen. And they'll be there until, it depends on the species, but with Columbia spotted frogs, they're going to be probably out and moving around in early March, even late February. Huh. So they are pretty tolerant of cold temperatures.
Neat.
So Utah's a really dry state. Do we have, you know, when you think of amphibians like frogs and toads as being in like relatively wet areas,
right.
So do we have small amphibian populations compared to other areas of the country? What does that look like?
We definitely have lower diversity than some other states, but that being said, some of the frogs that we do have are really well adapted to the conditions and are, you know, what you would consider fairly rare nationally. Boreal toad being a good example, some of our spadefoot toads. So we have low diversity, low actual numbers of species, but we do have some very unique amphibians. We have approximately 15 amphibians that are native to the state of Utah. And again, some of those, like boreal toad, have evolved for these specific conditions that they can find here in Utah.
So while we're talking about amphibians statewide, this is maybe a good time to talk about the new app that we mentioned in our intro. Tell us about this app you're working on.
Yeah, we're almost finished with it. I believe if you go to the Amazon App Store right now, you can find a version of it for Android. If you just do a search for Utah Amphibians or Utah Amphibians Field Guide, essentially what we've designed is a nice app that you can download on your phone. It's for free right now, and we're working towards getting a free version available for iTunes. Hopefully that will be happening in the next couple of months. It has pictures of all of the state's amphibians. It has information, you know, about where you can find them, range maps. You can click on, I say, for instance, if you chose spotted frog, it'd give you the option to look at the range map. It'd give you the option to view additional photos of that species. And there's also a very unique feature that will allow you to what we call report a sighting. So if you're viewing a picture of a Columbia spotted frog and you've decided you've seen one of these, you can click on an app. It will automatically fill Columbia spotted frog or whichever species you're on. You can insert your location. You can then send that information to us, essentially. And that's really important. We're trying to get the public involved in helping report these amphibians. We just recently had a success story a couple of years ago. We were doing surveys for boreal toads. We, being the division and our partners, could not find them along the Wasatch Front. We knew historically we were there, but we couldn't find them. We created some signs to put at trailheads and got the public interested in looking for them. 2 weeks later, they helped us rediscover a population of boreal toads that we had no inkling was still there. So it's very important. We'd love to get the public more involved, obviously from the education outreach, but they can also help us know where some of these amphibians
are. Sure, citizen science at work.
Great. Right, and at its finest.
Yeah.
We've had great partners involved in that. Swanner's been great. Hogle Zoo has helped us tremendously with this app. So the more people we can get interested, obviously the better.
So one last thing that we wanted to talk about, we have a couple of minutes before we need to wrap up, is the Wildlife Action Plan that you're working on right now for the division. So give us the overview of what that is.
So the Wildlife Action Plan, we often call it the WAP for short, it's essentially our overarching wildlife management plan for sensitive species throughout the state. We created our first one in 2005, and that helped us compete effectively for funding through Fish and Wildlife Service. It helped us coordinate our partners and essentially put together a game plan throughout the state. We're now working on an updated version for 2015. We will be providing that a draft for that in the next couple of months for public review. I don't know yet where that would be, but I'm sure if you go to our DWR website, we eventually have a link to that once that draft is available. And again, that's really just helping us get our partners united. It's laying out what we need to do to not only recover spotted frogs, but every other species, sensitive species within the state over the next 10 years.
Big goals.
Long timeline.
Chris Crockett, we want to thank you for taking the time to chat with us. Chris is an aquatic biologist with the Utah Department of Wildlife Resources. And Columbia spotted frogs coming to the Swanner Preserve and perhaps a window well near you. Be friendly with them. They're important. They're important species, indicator species, like Chris was saying, as far as prey and predator. So they play an important role in our ecosystem. And Chris, we want to thank you for all the research you're doing and spending time to come on this green earth. Thanks again. We'll stay in touch. Hey, let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we got several guests talking about a film, a panel, Q&A, a fierce green fire.
That's right. All centered around Park City History Museum's current exhibit.
It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power offers watt-smart advice such as avoiding the use of large appliances like a washer or dryer between 2 and 8 p.m. because it helps reduce energy demand and keeps costs down for all of us. More ways to save energy at wattsmart.com.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage service provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more each year in their residential curbside recycling bin. Please help by putting acceptable recyclables in and keeping glass out. Thank you, Summit County. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak, trusty co-host across the board, as always. And in the studio with us, we have a full house for the second half of the show. We have Katie Wang with the Park City Film Series. We have Jeanette Purdy with the Park City Museum. And we have Robin Geist with the Summit Land Conservancy. And you guys are all here to talk about your upcoming programs that are kind of centered around or initiated with this exhibit at the Park City Museum.
Yes. So at the Park City Museum, we have a space where we bring in traveling exhibits. And, you know, every 2 or 3 months it rotates. This time we have an exhibit called Wildland, Thomas Cole and the Birth of American Landscape Painting. And one of the great themes that we really pulled out of the exhibit was, you know, how this painting and art led to conservation movements and the importance of seeing land for, you know, the value of the intrinsic value of that land. And just as we were thinking about public programs, we, of course, thought about some of our great community partners here in Park City that know all about land and that would be great to partner with. So, you know, Summit Land Conservancy, we talked to them and they approached us. And then Katie Wang at the Park City Film Series, we always love to work with her and we have a great film coming up there. So that's kind of the genesis of how we all got together. We have some upcoming events that we're really excited about.
Right.
So, yeah, so should we go in chronological order here, maybe? Yeah. So I think the next event related to this is the panel. Is that right?
That's right. We have coming up on Tuesday, October 14th at McPullen Farm, which is the big white barn as you're coming into Park City. I think everyone knows that, kind of an iconic landscape for Park City. Again, Tuesday, October 14th, 5:30 to 7 p.m., we'll have a panel discussion on the history of conservation in Park City. Also how it influences artists in our area. We have essayist Tom Clyde who will come in and artist Allison Willingham. And then to end it off, where is the future of conservation? We have Park City Day School students who will be attending and talking about what they encountered working with us the last school year. They came out to McPullen Farm once a month throughout the 2013-2014 school year and produced a book. So
what's next in land conservation is a big question.
It is. You know, the land wasn't saved by accident in Park City. It took a lot of work, and that's what some of our panelists will be discussing. We have Executive Director Cheryl Fox, Miles Radiman, and former Mayor Dana Williams talking about the history. But where do we, you know, who do we hand off the gauntlet to when we're finished with our work? But saving land is never finished, so we do need that next generation.
Right.
Fantastic.
And it's being held at McPullen, which is unusual. Not a lot of events get held out there, but there's a good reason that's there, because that's an iconic structure and piece of property.
It is. And the Friends of the Farm work to preserve the structures that are on that property. And they do hold events that are free and open to the public and that benefit the community. And this joint venture with Park City Museum fits very well into their mission.
That's great. So that's next Tuesday from 5 to 7.
5:30 to 7 p.m.
Okay.
And space is limited, so we are requiring RSVPs just so we can make sure that the people that really want to come hear this, and we know there's a lot, but that they can have a seat. They should RSVP to education@parkcity.org. I'm sorry, parkcityhistory.org.
Okay. Is there a fee or suggested fee?
It is free and open to the public.
Fantastic.
We know that these community members will continue supporting Park City Museum and Summit Land Conservancy.
Right. Okay.
And Park City Film Series as we go forward.
Yeah, well, let's,
with the next event.
Right. Well, let's talk about Park City Film Series and the next event. And that's Katie Wang is here to talk about A Fierce Green Fire. Katie, what's that all about?
So, great film that came through Sundance in 2012. And actually, it's based on a book by Philip Shabakov, who is a New York Times columnist. And it's actually one of my favorite books. When I was in college and really kind of opening my own mind and thoughts to the conservation movement, it was one of the seminal books in my own personal education about the environment. So to then have it transformed into film, which is something I also love, was fantastic for me. So when Jeanette started talking about Thomas Cole, and he wasn't a painter that I'd really heard about, I was more familiar with his successors like Albert Bierstadt, but really the idea of looking at the landscape without people in it. And that's really something I think that Thomas Cole brought to American landscape paintings. So, to me, in my mind, it seemed like a great fit with The Fierce Green Fire, which really chronicles the beginning of the conservation movement in the United States with John Muir and the Sierra Club and going into David Brower and bringing it all the way to current day with the movement against climate change and 350.org. So it's really, it's a nice overview of where the conservation movement started. I mean, you certainly talk about dam building. Now, of course, we're at dam removal 40 years later. You Love Canal. I mean, some of the really seminal moments in the environmental and conservation movement of how the American people decided, you know what, we really need to stand up for nature because nature can't protect herself. So it's something that we thought would be a nice kind of bookend for the exhibit, you know, starting that conversation, coming with Summit Lands Conservancy and talking about what's happening in our own location in Park City, but then kind of bringing it back out again to look at more of the global level. So, you know, we thought it was a great kind of pairing, if you will, of all of these different events.
So tell us a little bit about maybe like the mood or the takeaway from A Fierce Green Fire. I know sometimes environmental documentaries, and I love them, of course, but they can get you down, you know, and you can kind of leave feeling like, what next? The world is falling apart, you know?
Absolutely. And this film, I think, it's really empowering. Because you see people like Lois Gibbs and Love Canal who, you know, they're having miscarriages, children are being poisoned. They really don't have control over their environment, over their health, over their safety. And they took matters into their own hands. And they really made a difference. And they made a difference not just for themselves and their own families, but for generations that followed them. So that, I think, is a very powerful point of both the book and certainly the movie. And then bringing it to current day where you talk about 350.org and what Bill McKibben has done with his organization. You know, this was 2 years ago, and certainly they've gained much more traction with the climate rally that they had in New York recently. So I think what it shows you is the power of individual voices, that you don't have to just kind of sit down and take it, that you really have the power within yourself and within your community. And that's certainly what we saw, you know, with the McPolin Farm, that the community 20 years ago said, you know what, not much is developed here, but we know development's coming. So we need to protect the spaces that we hold dear. And that's what they did, I think, to great effect. And, you know, thank goodness for them, right? What would we do without the McPolin Barn and without that beautiful landscape that we have coming into Park City? So that's something that I think the film really brings, you walk away with. We're also going to bring in the filmmaker, Mark Kitchell, via Skype. Hmm. So we'll have a Q&A with him after the film. And we do want to thank Fire Films and Linda McReynolds for helping us to bring the film to Park City and making it all possible with Mark and having his participation. I mean, just a world-class filmmaker to have his participation and his voice in our community is something that we really appreciate.
Right. In addition, Katie, like you talked about, the film covers the efforts to prevent the production of dams around the Western rivers, some successes, some failures.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It talks about Love Canal and then the Reagan era, which kind of counterattacked a lot of environmental movements by, as they describe, hiring pro-business political hacks like Ann Gorsuch to run the EPA and James Watt to oversee the Department of Interior. And then they turned towards Greenpeace, the evolution of Greenpeace in its efforts to halt whaling. although there's been a lot of successes there, there's still challenges with respect to Japan that continues to harvest whales under the guise, the definition of scientific research, right? And then it turns to the Amazon and the deforestation that's going on in the Amazon and efforts there by Chico Mendes back in the 80s, late 80s, to control, better control the unwanted deforestation of the Amazon. And he lost his life as a result of that. So it chronicles some really fascinating individual stories, individual efforts, and finally wraps up with Bill McKibben and climate change and 350.org. But Nell was saying, a lot of films that have a tendency to have a kind of a gloomy outlook to it. What's the point? But this is kind of hopeful. It ends in a hopeful way because there's now thousands of environmental movements all around the world that address either, you know, overarching global issues, climate change or whaling or other deforestation, but local efforts too. And then that kicks back to Summit Lands Conservancy. That's a local effort to save land.
Absolutely. And that's something that was really important to us and is important with all of our screenings. You know, I hate going to films where it gets you so excited and so invested in a topic. And then you go out, you leave the theater and you think, what do I do with that? Who do I talk to? How do I connect? And there's nothing there. So that's really something for us. It's important through our partnerships with the museum and with Summit Lands Conservancy, kind of as the side benefit of that is, okay, you get activated, you find out what's going on historically, how people have made a difference as individuals within their own communities against huge odds. And sometimes, as you said, you know, they've lost their lives, you know, fighting this fight. But you walk away from that, you say, okay, well, what can I do? Okay, you can go to Summit Lands Conservancy. We have activity and we have organizations within our community that are, you're not alone, basically, in your love of the environment, in your want to protect it. That there is activity and there are organizations that you can connect with. And that's something, you know, we are not an environmental organization. We're a film organization.
Right.
But film is a very powerful medium to bring the conversation to the present day in 90 minutes to really get people up to speed on a topic in a meaningful way and then give them the resources to say, okay, what's the next step I can take? And that's the connection that we like to do with our partnerships. So
when and where?
It is at the Prospector Theater, which is our new location this fall, which is 2175 Sidewinder Drive next to Silver Mountain Sports Club. And it is Thursday, October 16th at 7 p.m.
And
so
how
those
many
of you that are not here for you, that are not leaving town for UEA, please come. Bring your kids. It is family friendly. I mean, there are moments that are troubling, I think, in their content. You know, you do have, Chico Mendes, you certainly talk about him losing his life. But I think for middle school, upper middle school to high school kids, I think certainly it's an important conversation to have. It's probably no worse than what you hear on the news every day, unfortunately.
Right.
But it's a great film. It is free and open to the public. Again, thanks to people like Fire Films, the Park City Community Foundation, and Linda McReynolds for helping us to bring the film in and help us underwrite the costs for that. So like Summit Lands Conservancy, we want everyone to be able to come and participate and be part of that conversation.
Okay, great. Emphasis on the free.
On the free, parkcityfilmseries.org. You can check out the trailer for the film and, you know, find out about the event.
Okay.
Well, thanks to all three of you for joining us on the show today to talk about this.
Anything
Is there
else
anything
you
else
add?
We want to?
I did just want to say the exhibit that the Wildlands exhibit that's at the museum is here until October 20th. So there are just a couple more weeks of that. And we do have a local free day on Thursday. So that would be a great time to come check out the exhibit.
And then go see the film.
And then go see, come to the panel on next Tuesday and then the film on next Thursday.
Yeah. And it is a great exhibit, I have to say. And it's interesting to see in his paintings, the absence of humanity, and that was really the first time that happened, and just kind of opening your mind, because it's something we take for granted, that people don't always have to be part of the picture. And sometimes that's, if we talk about open space, that's the beauty of it, that it's a place like wilderness, right? It's a place where man does not remain.
Exactly. And Thomas Cole, he kind of was one of those beginning artists who started looking at land for, you know, the intrinsic value of land rather than what we can get from land, which you know, is a big part of our history here in Park City, but with the mining, but just seeing land for its value.
Are these Western landscapes or are they varied?
Thomas Cole was actually, so he never came to the West. He painted in New York, but his vision of landscape, you know, and at that time that was wilderness, you know, as the country started moving west, we started seeing more interest in those Western landscapes. But in the beginning, yeah, it was
more Hudson River Valley.
Exactly. He's the founder of the Hudson River Valley movement. So, artistic movement. So it is a great exhibit. So come to Free Day, then come to the panel.
And what are your hours at the museum?
So we're open 10 to 7, Monday through Saturday, and noon to 6 on Sunday.
Fantastic.
And one more time with Summit Land Conservancy event?
It is Tuesday, October 14th, 5:30 to 7 at McPullen Barn. RSVP to education@parkcityhistory.org.
education@parkcityhistory.org.
And then A Fierce Green Fire, Thursday, October 16th at 7 p.m., parkcityfilmseries.org for the trailer. We have a very nice large theater. Popcorn, of course, always served naked because you can add your own toppings and butter. So bring your friends, bring your family. Enjoy a great Q&A.
To leave that on. If you're thinking about that popcorn.
If you're thinking about popcorn, don't forget, we still have it there.
Any other environmental documentaries looking ahead, Katie? Anything in the environmental field?
You know, we've got, it depends on how you define environment. The following week, we have Sugar Babies, which is another free film that we're bringing to the community. And that's about the epidemic of diabetes amongst young people in our community and across the country. And we're doing that in partnership with the Live Well Center. We'll also have People's Health Clinic, Summit County Health, Park City Eats, the Christian Center, Jewish Family Services. So again, connecting, bringing up the topic, having a Q&A afterwards with the panel, but then connecting it back to the community. But yeah, we've calendared out through December, so we're actually looking now at our December films and thinking about what kind of fun things we can get into with our community partners. So,
okay. That's
sounds
great.
Like a plan.
No, those are great, great topics, critical topics. So, all right, well, Katie Wang, Executive Director of the Park City Film Series, Jeanette Purdy, with the Park City Museum, and Robin Geis with Summit Lands Conservancy. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting about your programs and your activities. And you all have websites one more time.
ParkCityHistory.org for the Park City Museum.
Okay.
You can find Summit Land Conservancy at WeSaveLand.org.
And then Park City Film Series is ParkCityFilmSeries.org.
Simple enough. Thanks.
Now a prospector.
Thanks for all of you taking the time to come on chat about these things. All right. Let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the Uinta Express pipeline, that proposed waxy yellow crude pipeline that's going to run through portions of Summit County, what that means, and what are some of the challenges associated with it, and is it a good idea or not? It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Lund. On behalf of Recycle Utah, I'm asking you to help save our watershed. Yes, we're asking you to turn off your sprinklers now, but this is even better. On Saturday, October 11th, from 9 to noon at the Canyons, you have the opportunity to responsibly dispose of your paint, medications, TVs, batteries, and more. All that to save our water. It's clearly worth preserving. Recycle Utah, KPCW supporter, is a nonprofit organization bringing water conservation ideas to you since 1990. Check us out at recycleutah.org.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts, here to tell you about Park City Round Valley Clinic, a proud supporter of KPCW. At the Park City Round Valley Clinic, you'll find family practice medicine, pain management, urology, sports medicine, and internal medicine doctors. They're all accepting new patients, and some even have evening appointments available. The Park City Round Valley Clinic is located at 750 Round Valley Drive, just a stone's throw away from Park City Medical Center, and is part of the not-for-profit Intermountain Healthcare System.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and here with co-host Chris Cherniak.
Yeah.
And as our last guests were walking out, kind of as an afterthought, Katie Wang mentioned, oh, and we have an amazing film festival coming up this Thursday.
This
so we want to mention that this Thursday at 7 p.m. The Park City Film Series is hosting the 5-Point Film Festival. And these are films about connecting with your passion. And a lot of them that I guess have been selected for Park City have to do with the out-of-doors. So they'll have films about, you know, a guy building tree houses in an area damaged by a tsunami. They'll have a story about a paraplegic learning to surf, about people hiking the route of one of the last, you know, free-flowing rivers in their area. So there's a whole wide variety of sort of connection of films that talk about connection to the land and to the out of doors. And that's $10 for adults and $5 for kids. And again, is hosted by the Park City Film Series at 7 p.m. this Thursday.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I'm looking at the website of this company, and they said, we avoid films solely about hucking yourself off of a cliff and love films with a story and a human element. And our best films embody our five guiding principles. So it's not just action adventure films. It's films that have kind of like a larger story or context.
It's not just the Warren Miller thing where they just
show exactly. That's
the same four people skiing
hucking
down
themselves
the same,
off of cliffs.
What looks like the same four mountains. For 2.5 Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
They're not like that. Good. All right. Well, that Park City Film Series, amazing stuff. Great films. Starting this Thursday.
That's right.
Okay. Hey, let's take a few minutes. I wanted to kind of summarize an event that happened, it's almost 2 weeks ago. The St. Luke's Episcopal Church periodically holds their forums, they call it the Park City Area Project for Deeper Understanding. And a couple of Tuesdays ago, they held one on the proposed Uinta Express Pipeline, Pros and Cons, as it was titled. And first, Father Charles does a great job there in hosting these events and these taking on these kind of complicated topics. And so I had the opportunity to be on the panel of quote-unquote, you know, experts or so in one area of either pipeline technology or land-related issues, and I kind of was the environmental engineer consultant that kind of gave some insight into some of the environmental challenges that might be associated with constructing and operating a pipeline. So first, just a minute just to kind of summarize what this pipeline's about. Most people should know that this is a 12-inch diameter line that would be installed about 3 or 4 feet deep, run about 135 miles, but 14 of it runs through a portion of Summit County. Now, that final route hasn't been decided, right? In fact, now one of the proposed routes comes close to Swanner.
It does. It comes just near the northern boundary of the Swanner Preserve, and we actually haven't been able to get an answer on whether it's inside or outside of that that boundary line, that property
line. They're still working on that.
Yeah.
They'll be in touch. So they're in the process of going through the design and what's called the environmental impact statement. It's part of the NEPA process, the National Environmental Policy Act. So this line is a little different than most normal crude oil lines because there are already some gas and oil pipelines that run through portions of the county. But this line would convey an oil that's a little different from that typical image you have of black crude, liquid crude. This is a waxy yellow crude, high in paraffin. And because it's high in paraffin, the oil has to be heated to temperatures well over 100 degrees. And it has to remain at those warm temperatures and pumped at slightly above average pressures and keep it moving. Because if it doesn't keep moving, if it cools down, then it'll set up and the pipeline will then be kind of coated with wax and that, you know, you're not pushing as much oil and you're creating more pressure, et cetera, et cetera. So the line would have to be kind of either initially heated and then perhaps reheated at different stations along the way, okay, of this 135-mile length. So here's the thing. We talked about what is the pros and cons of this line. The one of the things, of course, is that if you construct the pipeline, this thing would convey roughly 60,000 barrels per day of oil. Okay, that's a lot. That's equivalent to 240 oil tankers. Those double tankers that we see rolling up and down the highway, 40 and I-80 every day. There's roughly 240 or so trucks already moving oil from eastern Utah to the refineries in Salt Lake City. This would kind of prevent or reduce that additional number by approximately 240. It's not going to remove all the existing trucks. It's just saying that if this pipeline goes in, an additional 240 or so trucks would not be added to the highway. It doesn't even guarantee that there would be more trucks, right? Because you can have existing trucks plus the pipeline, and then you may even have more trucks. But this is an effort to remove, at least reduce the total number of trucks on the highway. So if you live in Heber or otherwise near the highway, you might be for the pipeline.
Well, I was just going to say, this is, I think, one of those decisions that doesn't have a clear-cut answer. It's, and in, you know, it has environmental trade-offs in either way. And one of those is definitely going to be an air quality impact that those of us who live near the highway corridors of 40 and 80 would be impacted by. But installing a pipeline in the ground has huge implications in a lot of ways. This
right.
is heated.
It's
it
heated.
Puts the water quality at risk, drinking water. And then also I always think ecologically as far as our native plant communities and invasives that tend to come in along these disturbed areas.
Right. And Tesoro is the pipeline owner, really has never built a line like this. As far as we understand, a line like this in the U.S. I believe they may have built a line like this elsewhere, but not in the U.S.
Okay.
There have been some other lines. We've talked about lines that have failed. The Mayflower, Arkansas release a couple
right,
of years
absolutely.
Ago. Kalamazoo River back in 2010. That cleanup continues. That was Canadian tar sands. And Tesoro had a pipeline release in North Dakota about a year or so ago, literally a year ago,
right.
Where they tens of thousands of gallons were released in a farmer's field. So pipelines fail.
Right, and we've also seen issues right here near, in Utah, near Willard Bay and up Red Butte Creek as well.
So, but here was the kind of the takeaway of the group, felt that if all things equal, a pipeline is less risky to the environment than another 240 trucks on the highway. Okay, now I say it's less risky if it's designed, constructed, operated, and monitored properly. And I would include a couple of recommendations. I only got another minute or so, so be quick. That the design for this line include the consideration of double walling any pipe, portion of that pipe that runs beneath the water table, whether it's going to have to course streams or creeks or maybe wetland systems. Anytime it goes beneath the water table, it should consider either some double walling or an outside sleeve to add additional protection, okay? It should, those areas where it's being repumped, those stations along the way, should make sure that that ground beneath it is impermeable. Either have a liner underneath the repump station or the tanks that are there, or the soil needs to be compacted to a degree that engineers would consider impermeable. So, and it should be bermed. So if there is a release in those stations, any oil that gets released will have a tendency to remain on that property. So there's a number of design elements that can go into this to help make that pipeline a little safer with respect to the environment. So it may be overall, you know, trucks have a tendency to run off the road and they fail and they get old and I've seen some of those trucks and they look like they remind me of that film Duel back in 70. They're evil. But anyway, that's the situation right now with the pipeline, and that was some of the takeaways. You know what?
It is time to wrap up.
We're out of time. Remember, this is 91.9 FM KPCW in Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Here's NPR News.